clearing the fears and Luca. I'll open up to questions from the audience shortly. I just want to start off by asking a couple of questions to get things going. And my first question to Dean is, well, can you tell us a bit more about the visual aspect of the film and how are you, where are you sourced and what method you use for doing archive footage and that kind of thing?
Okay. Well, there's this amazing archive on the internet which is created by these guys called Rick Prelinger and Skip Eisenhower. And if you go to archive.org, they've actually collated all of these old films, public information films, you know, advertisements, all the kind of crazy stuff, social engineering films that you see, and they've made them available for free, open source, to use and to create stuff with, and you can download them from archive.org. But there are literally thousands of them, so I've watched, I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of these films and immersed myself in this insane world to kind of, create what you've seen, I guess. And I mean, the creative process was, I filmed the fees in an initial interview. It was going to just be kind of like a quick YouTube thing to promote his new book, which is the film based on. And it kind of spiraled. I got into this archive and started putting stuff together. And then that's when I started experimenting with Luca as well. We kind of made that first animation together. And then, kind of became a film, I guess.
Actually, can I ask Luca as well, at what stage you got involved and how you were making the animations?
Well, he asked me to do the unlimited growth sequence, which is the first one he's seen in the film. And so we created this character together, the unlimited growth monster, and kind of spiraled from there. So we started looking more individual sequences that would be good to animate, that need to be kind of clearly represented, but trying to come up with characters that would hook you in at the same time. So we create storyboards and discuss it together, and then I'll come up with the details and make it all with like just bits of paper and scissors, and then Dean would speed up on the computer. That was the process, really. And there's a lot of experimenting and a lot of ones we didn't use because we were learning a lot from the process and never really done anything like that before. So it took a lot to learn. But it was very exciting to be able to illustrate Nafisa's work like that.
So Nafisa, did you ever envisage when you were writing the book that it might become a film? And now it has become a film. And what do you think it's added a new dimension to your ideas, or perhaps getting them across to people?
Yeah, well, when I was writing, but obviously I was a little kind of half grand conspiracy to do it. I wouldn't target Dean in making a film. So it was really, I mean, the whole way it happened was really organic, as Dean said. It was a complete accident. He didn't even plan to make a film. He just got excited by the concept and the ideas. Definitely the process of doing the interviews and sitting there for hours and answering these questions and having this really interesting conversation with Dean forced me into kind of think of new ways to simplify what I was saying and make it accessible, make it understandable. Because actually, even though at one level it seems complex, when you get down to it, it isn't actually that complex when you get to the basic concepts. So for me, it was a massive learning process as well. It's really been useful for me. And I think apart from the fact that it's just like a dream come true as an author, to have someone make a film in your book, it's just like, oh, this is amazing, it's really amazing. I mean, there's two things for me. One is basically, it's kind of, I've learned a lot about how to communicate. It's actually really impacted, and it's changed my writing style. I can write academically, but I'm now more interested in exploring interesting and diverse ways of communicating, not just doing the dry academic thing, which only reaches very narrow audience. And the other thing I think which is really interesting about the film is just that it's a tool now. For us, it's an activist tool to get people who are interested in different elements of what's happening to come together and talk about what's going on across their disciplines and across their activism and work together and think holistically about the kind of alternatives that we need to be thinking about. And actually that's what the message of the film is very much about: spontaneous action, communities coming together and just doing it, not waiting for power to make decisions for us, but us taking power by doing it.
Okay, let's go to the audience. Do you have any questions for any of our guests? Yeah.
This is for the phase. I'd like to ask, do you draw any inspiration from any particular people on your film? What do you say in the film? Is there any particular inspiration from people in the past, or any authors now, or academics that kind of pushed you in that direction of this book and how the film?
Well, I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's difficult to kind of pinpoint any particular one individual. But I would say that, first of all, there were certainly kind of pioneers in kind of systems theory, systems thinking, as you can refer to. But I think broadly, with some people who have kind of looked at this kind of area, like Thomas Homer Dixon, who is quoted in the book, is worth looking at in terms of, he also tries to do a holistic approach, but we might have a critique of him in my book, but he's still very, very good. So people like that inspire me, who are already kind of pioneering this kind of holistic way of thinking. But I mean, the book is based, it's not just, you know, I'm not saying, on each of these crises, I'm not saying something radically new in the sense that I'm not the person saying the things. It's actually other experts who are saying it, who are obviously often not well known. So climate scientists who are saying that we're actually, you know, we may have reached a tipping point, are not necessarily very well known and are not being listened to in the policymaking community. The same, the idea that we've actually passed peak carbon, again, a lot of industry experts are saying that. Again, it's not really trickled down into public discourse. So on the whole range of things, what I've tried to do is analyse the experts and the answers out there, make it accessible to people so that people can really just have, in a way, like a guide for what's going on. So my inspiration has really been the people, the courageous academics and activists, people who are at the forefront of these things, trying to find stuff out. And all I've done, really, is just put it together and try to develop a framework to understand why all these things are happening at the same time and then the way they're happening and what it means.
A couple of things. One is that it appears there's one crisis that you haven't really touched on, and that's the mass extinction. And it looks as if we're kind of currently in the planet's sixth mass extinction, and the kind of sum total of human activity on the planet is we're basically committing a planetary level ecocide. There's that. And then the other one was, I think the film has got a lot of potential, perhaps, with the wave of occupations we've seen around the world. And what do you think about those? And have you thought about how you could get the film kind of screened in occupations in cities around the world?
Yeah, well, on the first issue of the crisis and things, I mean, definitely, I think the ecological crisis is the kind of mass extinction that's going on is being described as part of this ecological footprint that we've got. But we had to, I had to make a choice as a writer while navigating the different crises. What is it that I've tried to focus people's attention on? What do I focus on? And why do I leave out certain things? And a lot of people have said, why don't you talk about water scarcities and other crises all over? And the thing is, I actually mentioned some of them. I mentioned a lot of these crises in the context of these issues. But it's what I tried to do is let's see what is the causally the kind of the crisis that significant in understanding the way the system works. So the reason we focused on climate change is, number one, it's a big issue in public consciousness. People kind of get, when you say climate change, they don't get what you're talking about. So use that to direct people to the nature of the system and our reliance on certain types of energy. So I had to make certain hard decisions like that. So there's loads of stuff that is not in the film, and there's some things which aren't in the book as well. On the second issue of Wall Street, definitely. I think on the one hand, it's a prediction. The book was published before Occupy Wall Street, and one of the things that the book predicted is that there's going to be much more protest movements, and this will become an escalating trend. It won't go away. And this is part of the transition process, but equally there will be an escalating trend of militarization to deal with, which would be mistaken. But there is a seed of opportunity here. So I think there's massive synergies with the Occupy movement. I think probably Dean could have a lot more to say.
Well, I agree with what Peter said in terms of seeing much more kind of civil protests and Occupy stuff. I fully support that. But we also need to be very mindful of the fact that when you have governments that are faced with, as the fee says, as we're saying, from losing control, it will start to act more aggressively. It will start to oppress minorities and people that they can pick on, such as the communities of Dalfarn that we've seen recently that have been evicted from their land and their land. And so we have repressive governments coming down on minorities. So we need to have this holistic point of view. And I think that, you know, it's great that people are occupying some walls and Wall Street, but then there are communities that need to be defended. So, and until we realise that all of these things are connected, I think perhaps, I guess what I'm saying is that my ambition for the film is that people will do activism and they will be a bit more informed or understand a bit more clearly about how everything works so they can communicate their ideas better and think about how to focus their energies. And I'm not saying we're the first people to do this, but I think what we're trying to do, what I've tried very hard to do, is that you watch a film and you feel inspired to take action, and you've seen something that's visually interesting with Luca's artwork and the films that I've used, and it makes you feel empowered rather than feeling despondent, because many of these films, you watch them and you might feel, afterwards you feel like kind of depressed or something, like you can't do anything because of the spooky music and ominous tone. Not all films are like that, but in this genre you do get a lot of that. And so I was kind of quite mindful to try and keep it upbeat, which is why, you know, have those people playing xylophones at the end of the day. And like, go out with a good tune in your head. So,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, go, you go.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to do some screenings at the Occupy stuff in London, but also in communities all around the country and around the world as well. And the aim for it is to really people to pick it up themselves and to want to use it as a tool and to show it in really, like, small venues and little town halls or in the summer outside, like everywhere. So hopefully that will happen, but it's up to everyone who's seen it and liked it to kind of push that forward.
Yes, so I really enjoyed it, thank you. The question in my mind was the brilliant archive stuff you'd found. Really enjoyed that too, but I was interested just to find out if you thought that was an accurate description of the genesis of the problem, or, you know, if there had been any Victorian footage of British Empire around the world, whether that might be more accurate or less.
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting. I mean, what I thought was fascinating about the films that Dean used, because a lot of these films are from the 40s, 50s, 60s, which was the kind of height of industrialization, when we didn't really have any doubts about how brilliant we were doing. And that is really particularly in the film. As Dean mentioned, a lot of the films were basically propaganda films, which were made by companies like Monsanto and others. So what I found really amazing about the process was you have this backdrop of these films where they're kind of, all these characters are kind of glorifying and reveling in how brilliant it is. And then even me sitting there talking about this underbelly of actually what's going on now. And so it creates this kind of paradoxical, surreal effect, which I think helps you kind of look today at the kind of propaganda we've got now, which we kind of take almost at face value, the advertising. And if you look back then, I didn't think that was very funny. That was kind of the way it was. So if you look, kind of in a way, it throws that opening light on the narrative that you have in the mainstream media today, and how we take it for granted. But actually, maybe it's as absurd and silly as the stuff that we saw then. So I thought it worked really well.
Yeah, I mean, I could have tried. I kind of just got into this thing of creating this crazy, surreal journey and went with it. And obviously, yeah, some of it could have been, you could have gone down that road of being more specific and using stuff which related more to what the fees have. But also, you have to recognise that this is a guerrilla piece of filmmaking made out of stuff I had and I could find and put together out of these archives and all this old stuff. And so, it was a case of using what I had, essentially, as well. So, hopefully, it kind of worked.
Yeah.
Sorry,
is I think population growth is obviously a major factor that needs to take into consideration. And the film emphasises this point that we need to stop growing. And I think that's a general thing that cuts across, including population as well. There's a limit to how much you can grow overall. But you see, the reason I didn't want to make population a causal thing, a lot of people say population is a driving cause of our problems, is that if you look globally and you look at the correlations, a lot of the people who advocate this, a lot of them are major scientists, they have these graphs. So you've got a graph of population growth going up like that, and then you've got a graph of overall global energy consumption going and then they say, okay, so then you've got the environmental crisis going and there's a correlation there. So therefore population growth is one of the causes, the fundamental cause of this problem. It actually is not true, because you have to, if you break it down locally, region by region, nation by nation, you find that countries where population growth is actually very rapid and quite massive are largely in the south, where the rate of population growth is totally out of control, but the energy consumption is totally minimal. Their footprint is tiny. Whereas you look at the north, the west, the US, Western Europe, and so on, where population growth is now, in some cases, actually going starting to decline, rates of population growth. And energy consumption is massive and rocketing way out of control. So what I argue is really that population growth is a problem, but it's a symptom of the nature of the system, of the overall system. And just saying, okay, we need to have birth control, blah, 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 which some people advocate, isn't actually going to stop population growth from slowing down. What you need to do is you have to actually meet people's needs. In countries like the South, the reason populations are growing so out of control is because they see literally having more children as an economic, it's adding to your economic ability to work, and largely work in quite demeaning conditions, because that's the only option you have. Whereas here in the West, you know, population growth is stabilising and then kind of reaching the limit, precisely because we're able to meet our needs and we don't see population that way. So there is a kind of indirect, and a lot of sociologists have studied this, and there's a debate around this, and I'm happy to engage in that debate. A lot of people may disagree with me, and I think that's a legitimate disagreement to have, and it's a complicated issue, we should discuss it more. But that's where I stand.
We need to create more global equality for everyone. I know that's like how the hell do we do that? I don't know. But I think it's a good start to be out on the streets, it's a good start to be doing stuff.
And I'll ask on that, yeah, yeah, I kind of get what you're saying now, thanks to Dean's elaboration, but yeah, the last thing we're advocating is the idea that, oh, here we are in the West, those guys are down there, and we should bring them up higher or somewhere, because this model of development that we've spearheaded in the West is a failure, it's a failed model, it's insane, and the idea that then in the South should follow a failed model is also insane. What we need is an alternative model. And the alternative model would mean that, yes, it would mean that our societies here would change fundamentally the way we do things. It wouldn't mean that they would now suddenly become industrialized in the traditional sense. Does that mean that they don't have any technology whatsoever? No. But it means that the same principles of empowerment of localization, participatory economics, for example, participatory forms of agriculture, those things are where we have innovative attempts to do that. For example, in places like Africa, there are some schemes where people are trying to do this. There's been some really amazing developments from that, where, for example, farmers have been able to maximize their yields, not using industrial methods, using organic methods. Again, those methods are in their control. They're much more localized, they're able to feed their own people, and you don't have external entities coming in. The other thing is, as well, is that we're not belligerent about the pathway. We don't want to say, this is the definite answer. Us having this conversation is part of this, is what we're saying needs to happen, that isn't happening. People aren't having that conversation about what we need to do and how we need to get it. So even this conversation about population, we need to be actually engaging really concertedly as a society, in constant dialogue about these issues, and let the solution emerge organically. Because the problem is that the solutions that we're given, these techno fixes, are given by people with certain vested interests, and often, sometimes they think they're doing it for everybody's benefit. Some people do, but they're wrong because they don't understand. And so we need more people in part of that process of dialogue.
So we have another question. Someone raise their hands over here.
I'd like to ask if you think we emphasise that the role of civil society is going to be really important for us to kind of change attitudes and kind of society and to kind of try achieving more kind of sustainable future. At what point do you think that governments will start to take notice of this kind of change in thinking? Do you think all governments ever kind of realise that civil society is kind of, I don't say rising up, but it's kind of we've got a shift that people actually taking action, doing things for themselves, and whether that be in Africa or whether that be here in the UK, I think governments have started to take notice and really change their policy accordingly.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to say. I mean, I don't like to make kind of hard and fast predictions about what will happen. I mean, you can kind of say what will happen if certain trends continue. So that will happen if this happens. But I think it's really open, because I think, you know, I've spoken to people in government and I've worked at some level of trying to speak to these guys. And most of the time, they're just like you and me. They're people on a salary, right? They are part of the 99% in reality, even though they don't necessarily know it. And they just blink it. They literally don't necessarily understand what's going on and how it's going on. They don't have access to the right information. Even their researchers and their advisors are blinkered and work within a certain box. So what I've found is that when you give sometimes information to those people, they actually find it really interesting and they think, oh, that's changed the way I think about it. Maybe I can do something about that. But at the same time, there are fundamental limits to the kind of activities that they can do. And this, one of the things that the film, the kind of the theoretical background of the film, and it's articulated more in the book, is that the state is a sort of struggle between the popular will, the democratic state is a struggle between the popular will and these different kind of interest groups, lobby groups, media corporations, blah blah blah, who keep trying to influence the state in their own direction. And that struggle is one that people at that level of the state and the bureaucracy, it's a very real struggle, and they will actually, if you manage to get some of these guys in the room to speak frankly, they will admit but they're constantly having this kind of put to and fro, tug of war. So on the one hand, I think that we shouldn't stop talking to government and trying to and lobbying government through the normal established channels that we have in democratic society. We should do that more and more and more and keep doing it. But at the same time, we should be pragmatic and realistic about how far that can go. Because unless that system actually changes, then those vested interests will still be able to pull those levers. That has to be a fundamental structural shift. Now, the overall message of the book or the film is that before the end of this century, this civilization in its current form isn't going to exist. It's not going to survive. That doesn't mean it's all just going to build and blow up and die, although that is a possibility. But it means that if you look at the current trends, there's just no way this civilization in its current form will survive. It will have to be different. The question is that going to happen through choice, or is it going to happen, are we going to be forced, and is it going to be a dystopian, are we going to make the wrong decisions? So I think along that path, these structures are not going to survive, they are going to fail. And that creates a space of opportunity for action at many different scales, political action, economic action, cultural action. And I think within the next, I think now already we're seeing people are opening up to alternatives. They're realizing that there needs to be a change. But they're not necessarily quite sure how and why, and they're not sure how things fit together. And then I think 10 years down the line, I think if you say peak oil isn't real or climate change isn't happening, people will laugh you out of the room. I think things will be much more difficult to debate. And I think we've had, over the last 10 years, I think that process has happened. Most people are sceptical of the Iraq war. You ask anybody in the street and they'll tell you that all the banks got us into this economic mess. People are sceptical of foreign policy. People are sceptical now of Parliament. Everyone's aware of this insidious relationship between people like Rupert Murdoch, the politicians. So there is this growing awareness, I think, on the grassroots that something is deeply wrong. People are just not sure where to go with that. So I think, again, 10 years' time, I think it will be very, very difficult for government to simply ignore it. But how that plays out is a matter of... So it's up to us.
Actually, in the film, the discussion of the economic possibility. Obviously, one of the main measures is GDP. And it seems when you have something like GDP, which capitalism can increase, and then argue that it's doing good jobs, it's increasing values. And basically, what is, of course, on the alternative measures of development, apart from GDP?
There's a number of guys who I'd recommend looking up. There's obviously Amartya Sen, the Nobel Prize winning economist. He wrote a book called Development as Freedom, where I think he was the first to really articulate this idea that economic development and growth should be, we should develop new kinds of measures which deal with the capacity to meet certain basic needs. And so the needs, whether material needs like to do with hunger and things like that, but there are also kind of basic kind of cultural and spiritual needs. I think that's a really interesting way of doing it. And other people have taken this forward. So there's a guy called Tim Jackson, who is also an economist at the University of Surrey, who's written a book called Prosperity Without Growth, where he actually moves a bit more forward in trying to develop new economic models. Based on, it's inspired by a guy called Herman Daly, who talked about steady state economy. So he's trying to actually articulate how this could work economically. And he's actually come up with a whole model. There's a number of people around these guys who are doing this kind of work. So I think there's really interesting, exciting stuff being done. And I think what's more important than just the modelling is the change in consciousness. Because I think capitalism didn't emerge out of a model. There wasn't a guy sitting there who was the arch-capitalist who said, this is capitalism. And then, boom, it came into existence. People like Adam Smith theorized the emergence of capitalism after the fact. Capitalism emerged as a historical accident, to a response to certain crises. And I think whatever emerges out of this, you know, be it, you know, post-capitalism, whatever it could be, I don't know. Again, it's going to be organic, it's unpredictable, and it depends on what we do and what we choose. It could be regressive, or it could be something really positive. So I think it's important we have tools which they didn't have centuries ago to develop different kinds of models. But I think also it's important to drive a shift in consciousness where people actually don't prioritize and realize that prioritizing a certain type of behavior is actually not conducive to your happiness. It's actually completely the opposite. It's more likely to make you depressed. So I think that's another key. Just a shift in consciousness will create new forms of behavior, which will create new economies.
I think we have time for maybe one more question.
I was quite interested in the point of view before regarding when you speak to those journalists about trying to display it in a way that they actually seem that they're relatively well informed about that. I suppose one of the difficulties that's about how you perceive changing governments so that people are aware of these broader perspectives when you've got systems in most of the Western economies, at least, where you've got an extreme kind of subdivision of responsibility, where you have a minister who's responsible for housing and one for a mural, there's one for shoes or whatever. How do you create that system whereby people are encouraged to take these broader perspectives and have responsibility for that in those structures?
That's like a huge question. So how do you create the new world government? You know, I don't know. I think it's something that you have to work at it. And part of the process is why I wrote the book, it's why I made the film, which is just let's start the process of dialogue. I really believe fundamentally that it's a shift, it's about consciousness. If there is a majority of people who are aware of these issues, then government won't have a choice but to think about it differently, because everybody is thinking about it differently. But if we don't think about it differently, then that's not going to happen. Do you know what I'm saying? So I think the government will be forced to move. The question is, you know, they might resist it, and I think they will resist it. I think that's, to be realistic and honest with you, I don't think government at the moment, for the next 10, 20 years, seriously, is going to change the way they do things. I think they will take a lot of blood, sweat, and tears before government really changes. And that's because government in its current form, democracy is a fiction currently. It's not real. And that's the real fundamental problem. When they get to the point where the popular resistance reaches a critical mass, that it's able to kind of actually get to a point where government in a sense is irrelevant, and there needs to be something else. I think that's what we'll see, either in an adaptation or we'll see a change or something new will emerge. But I don't know, but I think it's about communicating with people, getting more people aware, again, talking to government, but talking outside government as well, and empowering communities. And I think what's the most important thing that we always try to emphasize is just it's about you getting off your ass and actually doing something. Not, you can't do everything, but you can do one small thing that you are able to do, that you're good at doing, and do that. And if you can do that, then you've made a difference. And if you can get other people around you to do the same, then that's where it starts, and that is what will have a snowball effect.
Thanks very much. We're running out of time, and I think that's an inspiring place to finish there. But I guess we'll still be around for a bit. I'm sure that we have this talk to you read at the outside of London about if you want to come and have a chat. But a big thank you for attending the exam.